This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The man once fondly known as America's dad now faces 3 to 10 years in state prison. In April, 81-year-old Bill Cosby was convicted of 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault and sentenced to prison last week.
This has been a long journey to justice for all of the accusers, particularly for Andrea Constant and for her family. This is a very important day. Judgment Day has come.
Attorney Gloria Allred representing some of the women speaking out against Cosby after sentencing last week. Cosby is the first high-profile celebrity to stand trial in the Me Too era, and his sentencing has renewed the debate about the power and limitations of the movement. It also raised questions about the fate of other powerful men facing accusations, like Harvey Weinstein and Brett Kavanaugh. And this is one of the topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll talk about Serena Williams' U.S. Open loss and Colin Kaepernick's new Nike ad and review a new docuseries about Trayvon Martin. Joining me for all that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Natalie, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
And Mark is a James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He is also an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, Frank.
I want to start with some tape, and I want to start with a clip from Andrea Constant, the woman who's won the case against Bill Cosby. And here she is in an interview earlier this year with NBC News reporter Kate Snow.
Andrea, you are now going to be known as the woman who took down Bill Cosby. How do you feel about that?
I never set out to bring down anybody. And I haven't necessarily because I'm not alone. This is a collective consciousness. And so I would rather say we brought down Bill Cosby, but I just had the shoes on.
Bill Cosby's accuser, Andrea Constant, talking with NBC News reporter Kate Snow earlier this year. Last week, of course, Bill Cosby sentenced to at least 3 years in state prison for sexual assault. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, what's your initial response?
I'm just struck by this idea of a woman taking down a man. It's just sort of the prevalent notion when a woman challenges or tries to hold a man accountable for his bad behavior, to say the least. And we see it in what's going on with Judge Kavanaugh's hearings and Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony and just the general attitude towards women. It just makes me think of how, you know, when President Obama was elected, you know, people swore we were post-racial. And I think that there has been this feeling in the Me Too era that we're like post-gender, let's say, or, you know, that we are in a different place. We are more aware and more conscious and more committed to dealing with and addressing sexual assault and equality and all these issues that swirl around gender. And we are just so far from being anywhere where we could say that we've resolved anything. And this case and the way that it, even though there are 60 women that have come forward to say that Cosby did something to them, that he assaulted them, raped them, drugged them, and so forth, we're still talking about how he was taken down.
Right, by one woman. And she made the point, of course, in the interview that, look, I am one of, she didn't say 60, but it turns out 60 women.
Right.
That's the way the courts work is we don't want 60, you know, 60 plaintiffs there.
Right.
Mark, what's your take on what's happening here?
You know, there's a lot of conversation. Folks are, in some sectors, weeping about this great fall of the sad old black man. There's a way in which Mr. Cosby lost a lot of social capital going back to the pound cake speech in 05. I think folks react very differently to this prior to 2005 than they do afterwards. What's been exposed about Mr. Cosby since 2005, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, is counter to the way that a lot of people want to remember him.
Right.
So on the one hand, you see an obvious accountability that needed to be had. But at the same time, there are people who are still trying to hold on to this ideal of bringing down this iconic black figure and needing to protect that legacy. What's been interesting in this moment is that, you know, suddenly folks now want to weigh in with their critique to the criminal justice system. So the conversations are all about, well, this happened to Bill Cosby. Why hasn't it happened to Harvey Weinstein? Understanding that, you know, the Cosby case actually goes back much further than the data that we have on Weinstein. So just in that context, the timing of it makes sense. But the politics of race beyond that, you know, for me, that's the wrong question. The question is not why is Bill Cosby in jail and Harvey Weinstein isn't. The question is why is Bill Cosby in jail and R. Kelly isn't? Because that gets to the question of who were victimized by these men. And if Bill Cosby had largely victimized black women, like R. Kelly has, the outcome may have looked very differently in this kind of moment.
That's right.
So, and what about this question of sort of statute of limitations about how far back we go? Because this gets us right to the Brett Kavanaugh discussion, right? I mean, yeah, do we hold people accountable for things that happened a long, long time ago? And that's been part of the discussion here, Natalie.
Right. But, you know, very smart gentleman that I know once said that, you know, if we can put teenage black and brown boys in jail, right? If we can detain them, you know, by resource officers in high school, and that ruins their lives, right? And there is no redemption, then absolutely we can look at a Brett Kavanaugh or we can look at a Bill Cosby and we can go all the way back to their what they did in high school in their 20s, 30s, and forward. And if there has not been a reckoning, if there has not been any accountability, then absolutely that counts. And it points to their current character, especially if they have not made amends for it.
And in the case of Bill Cosby, the social capital that he built over the years, his literal wealth was built on an ideal of who he as a character and as an individual. And everything that he's been accused of goes against that. And to some extent, he's been able to exploit women because of that ideal, right? And if he's been able to build wealth in the context of that, that wealth also has to collapse on the basis of those relationships.
And for the victims, there is no statute of limitations in terms of what they experienced. Most were not even able to bring him to trial because of the statute of limitations. Let's listen to a clip from one of those women, Victoria Valentino, who says Bill Cosby drugged and raped her in the late 1960s. She was talking to NPR last week.
Well, yeah, I saw this old man who was diminished, the man that we'd all been afraid of because he was so powerful and our lives had been dominated by him, whether it was in those few minutes that we were actually being raped by him or just the aftermath. But then when I saw this kind of jokey smirk on his face, all bets were off. And I remembered how arrogant and how pompous and how entitled he was. And then I realized, no, I have no compassion, no pity, because I know the destruction that he has caused in so many lives. And there is a generational trickle down because we all have intimacy and trust issues. We have a lot of issues that we don't even realize that we're passing on to our children, and then they pass on to their children. So I have no compassion for him. Last night was his first night spending it in a jail cell. And man, I think we are all absolutely delirious with joy.
That's Victoria Valentino speaking with NPR's Audie Cornish last week. And again, this question of statute of limitations or how far back we go, I mean, it also speaks to, does it not, Natalie, this problem of why women don't report these things. And again, if the issue is, well, if we have to go back that far, we're not going to talk about it anymore. It would seem to me that we would continue to have the dampening, chilling effect on coming forward if we say, well, no, don't go back that far.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that, there is psychological evidence. There have been studies done that speak to why women don't, or, victims of sexual assault and abuse don't come forward in the moments directly afterward. And especially for women, you know, the shame, the stigma, the fact that they're not going to be believed, the fact that they're most likely going to be blamed. I've read so many accounts on Facebook of women telling their story in light of what's going on with Dr. Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh, you know, who've talked about the trauma of a rape kit, you know, just being examined so that the evidence that can that needs to be gathered to even bring charges against someone who commits sexual assault, you know, just how traumatic that process is, you know, it's going to for a lot of people, that's going to put you off. You're not going to want to go through that. But it still does not diminish the significance of what has happened to you. And then the trauma, as Victoria Valentino talked about, the fact that that is generational, potentially, if it's never addressed, and especially if justice is never served.
Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark Anthony Neal, who is James B. Duke Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies. On the State of Things today, back channel. When we come back, Serena Williams lost the U.S. Open after a controversial spat with an umpire. We'll talk about that and more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's back channel today, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Still with me, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker who teaches at NC State. Mark is chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. And we turn our conversation now to Serena Williams. Last month, the famed athlete lost the U.S. Open to Naomi Osaka after a controversial spat with an umpire. Well, after that incident, a conversation erupted about sexism in sports. At some point, she called him a thief. He took away a point. She lost the match and became very upset. And, of course, the conversation then became centered around whether or not women, and maybe particularly women of color, are treated differently when it comes to their on-court behavior. What about that conversation, Natalie?
Well, I just want to add that not only was a point taken away, but I think a whole game was taken away, right? And so Serena was left at quite a disadvantage. But, you know, it's just a tired trope of the angry black woman that keeps getting imposed on Serena Williams. You know, she is one of these black women that I think white folks just cannot get with, because she is not the, oh, I'm so grateful, thank you, I love you, you know, just the demure, you know, grateful person that stays in her place, does not challenge basically white authority, and she's gonna come for you if you treat her in a way that she does not like. So she in many ways is not only fully expressed, but she is free. She is clearly feeling free to be exactly who she is. And a large part of that is unapologetically black. Like, she's not going to back down on, you know, any of that. She doesn't pay attention to the stereotypes. She doesn't really care about that stuff. And I think it's really unnerving in the tennis world, which is a largely white space, that this woman, you know, is loud and big and, you know, confident and in your face. And so, you know, she is going to be lambasted for hollering at the referee or, you know, standing up for herself when she has every right to do that. But women can't do that in public spaces without being called something.
Well, and it's interesting, when you try to make the defense, you end up reinforcing the stereotype. Let's listen.
There you go.
This is not fair, but to give me a point to lose a game for what we're saying, that is not fair. I mean, it's really not.
Yeah,
she called me. But you know how many other men, you know how many other men do things that are, do much worse than that. This is not fair. There's a lot of men out here that have said a lot of things, and because they are men, that doesn't happen to them.
Serena Williams at the U.S. Open last month. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. And Mark, I mean, that's it. If you really demonstrate about how unfair it is. And by the way, we did take a look to see how men were treated, and they're celebrated in a lot of ways. In fact, that becomes part of the view. John McEnroe, you may or may not be a great tennis player, but you're fun to watch, and fun to watch in part because you act that way. And it turns out that the penalties were not at all the same. We've got this stuff at our website. We can take a look at how men were treated for doing similar and even worse things.
So. I mean, John McEnroe, Ilya Nastase, Jimmy Connors to some extent, they helped build the brand of American tennis in the 80s and 90s, 70s and 80s, by bringing eyeballs to it because of this unfettered expression of white masculinity. There's an expectation when you're thinking about a championship meet in any sport that the referee will have a level of restraint that would allow for the decisions of the match to go down based on the play and not because of the heavy hand. And there are a lot of folks who were saying, well, yes, she was being outplayed, and that might be the case. But you're also talking about someone who's playing against someone who's in their first championship.
Right.
Against Serena Williams, who we don't know how she would have withstood the pressure had she actually lost a game and one of those matches and had to go on to a third match. I think the question that Serena raises, and I understand why she did what she did about would you treat a man like this, is her not wanting to ask the obvious question. The obvious question is not about, you know, do we treat men and women the same way in tennis? It's about this question of intersectionality. How do we treat black women in tennis, right?
That's a
level of specificity that no one wanted to wrap their heads around, right? Because she and her sister and now another generation of women, I think about Sloan in this context, right? Because in some ways she gets treated in very subtle ways by announcers in this same way, right? Because optically.
Yes.
Right. She looks more like Serena and Venus. I mean, that's really the question. How is the sport dealing with the presence of these black women who are so dominant and so visible? And you can feel in the tennis associations just wanting to hold on for another year or two so they no longer have a Williams problem.
Right.
Whether that's Venus, Serena, or Richard. Right. And the irony is that this young woman's father modeled her career based on what Richard does, to the extent that he couldn't sit there and watch his daughter win the U.S. Open because he refuses to be in the stadium at the same time, again, taking a book page directly from the Richard Williams book.
I mean, I just want to, you know, piggyback on what Mark just said and you know, mention something that the scholar Janelle Hobson said to me one time in an interview I did with her for the documentary that I'm working on. And she said that, you know, when black women show up in all white spaces, they are disrupting the body politic. And that just right there is going to set up a situation where folk are going to lose their minds and not know how to deal with that black body in that white space. And that is largely what we're dealing with. When it comes to Serena
talk about
Williams.
the fact that they wouldn't allow her to wear the cat suit in the French Open, right? I mean, again, this is so. I thought her comeback was interesting. She wore a tutu,
right.
But also, exactly. You know, we're not talking about Naomi Osaka here, who is a young woman from a biracial woman from Japan, who's shaking things up there, where biracial anything and is not particularly popular. And she wins. And then the dynamics. I mean, we talked about the fact that she's in your face, not demure, not Serena, not going to be the shy, retiring, grateful athlete that you were expecting. And yet, when she talked about being on the podium when the trophy was awarded, the two of them there, right? Naomi Osaka feeling the need to apologize. And Serena talking about how she felt, asking the crowd to quiet down and empathizing then with Naomi. Let's listen to what she had to say about that particular moment immediately after the match.
I don't know. I felt at one point I felt bad because I'm crying and she's crying and, you know, she just won. And I'm not sure if they were happy tears or they were just sad tears because of the moment. And, you know, I felt like, wow, this isn't how I felt when I won my first Grand Slam. So I was like, well, I definitely don't want her to feel like that. So Yeah, maybe it was the mom in me that was like, listen, we got to pull ourselves together here.
So there's a clip of Serena Williams talking after losing the U.S. Open match to Naomi Osaka last month. And I'm talking to Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Again, we talk about Connors and McEnroe and some of these others who created the brand, right? They never stepped back from that role. They were always in character, right? And it strikes me that what Serena's able to do is be not only a full-bodied woman, but a full human woman. She can be all those things. She could be the mom, she could be empathetic, and she can also be in your face, which a lot of these other athletes just can't seem to do. They can't seem to take off the game face.
Yeah, but Serena pays a price. Right. She does that. I mean, she has class. That's why she was, you know, willing to, you know, to be thoughtful and empathetic with Naomi Osaka, because she actually rides for Black women.
Right.
Serena is not, right. You know, right. She's right. Not about there ain't enough space for me and this other Black woman, you know, in the tennis world. No, she embraces all of the Black women in that space. And that's what we saw. And it's just striking that, you know, she can do that, that she has enough class and maturity to, like, in the moment realize that, you know what, I want this young woman to have a moment. Right. I want her to enjoy this moment. And she does what she needs to in order to ensure that she has that. You know, that right there should, like, trump the gratitude that's expected of her. I mean, she's showing something that a lot of people are not able to muster in that moment when they've lost to another champion. So, I mean, it's just unfortunate that not only as a Black woman, but, you know, that as women in that moment, Naomi is apologizing and Serena has to, like, pull back from her angle. You know, it's just ridiculous.
To some extent, does it also suggest that there's a little bit of control, which actually makes it more interesting? I mean, sometimes you think of an athlete losing control, this horrible thing happened, I'm going to scream and I'm going to shout. But in some ways, if you think about having that measure of empathy in the most awful moment, the giving the trophy to somebody else, and having the power of empathy and to calm down, suggests that she was even more in control when she was making the complaint about that was not the right thing to do.
Right.
That was in control. I was not out of control.
Right.
I'm telling you
hysterical.
What I'm thinking.
That's right.
It's not hysterical.
Or the fact that right after she had all this interaction with the referee, that she went back out there and held on to her serve. That was the one thing that it never missed. I mean, she was back to business when it was time to get back to business. If anybody had any question about whether or not Serena Williams owns the sport of women's tennis, the graciousness that she showed.
There you go.
During that ceremony showed you that this is her sport. She understands that she is bigger than the sport, and the responsibility that comes with that is making sure that the folks who are coming behind her have the right kind of process in which they can accept their success.
Let's
turn to another athlete now, Colin Kaepernick. Last month, he's not playing football anymore, but he is making money doing endorsements. This one for Nike named him the face of their new Just Do It campaign. Let's listen to this clip from the new TV commercial.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
Now, that's just a little bit of that ad. Colin Kaepernick, who's the new face of Nike's Just Do It campaign. Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Of course, the move by Nike garnered mixed response. I mean, this is the athlete who is known for starting the movement to taking a knee during the national anthem and is, by most accounts, being punished for it by not being picked up by any NFL teams. What do you think about this, Mark? This kind of commodity, so-called commodity activism, not new. What do you make of this? First of all, sort of his defiance being the face of a big corporation like Nike.
Nike's in the business of selling athletic gear, selling a lifestyle, and to the extent that there are historical moments where the selling of those goods and services align with a popular social movement, they're willing to. So whether it's them doing a series of commercials talking about your revolution using the Beatles in the 1980s, or Colin Kaepernick, or as I reminded my students and showed them last night, their Tiger Woods commercials from 1997, where you have all these little kids standing up going, I am Tiger Woods, I am Tiger Woods. Most Americans may be remembering that moment at the end of Malcolm X, Spike Lee's movement, where all these little boys got and girls got up and said, I am Malcolm X. Nobody remembering Father Clements describing in Eyes on the Prize, trying to explain to him how important Fred Hampton was after his death. And he tells the story of all these little kids who stand up and go, I am Fred Hampton. I am Fred Hampton, which is where Spike got it from. So in the 20-year period, we have replaced, you know, this icon and blueprint for the next generation of black social justice movers with someone who actually rejects the idea of being African-American, all courtesy of Nike. So I'm always a bit suspicious of these kinds of moments, let alone the fact that Nike, Colin Kaepernick had been signed to Nike for a while. They were kind of waiting for the winds of change to decide, you know, to run this commercial. The upside of this is that in the aftermath of all of this, you see the signing of Eric Reed by the Carolina Panthers. I think something that only occurs because of the new ownership.
And I'll talk about the significance.
The significance, right? That he Eric Reed was, you know, the one player, literally was his teammate with the San Francisco 49ers. They were also frat brothers. So he rode with Colin Kaepernick throughout the whole process, and he had not been able to get a job either for the last 2 years. They were both part of this collusion suit. So he gets signed by the Carolina Panthers just this last week. Yeah. Ironically, I think only because the Panthers have new ownership, the previous ownership being taken down, right, by the women's movement that's talking about, you know, what's happening in terms of gender and sexuality in the workforce.
So, again, a branding thing. If you want to market yourself as, no, we're the new NFL, we're not the old NFL, then this is kind of a smart business move for the Panthers. I don't know. Natalie.
Yeah, I mean, I was when I found out that Nike had put on Colin for this ad for their campaign, you know, I was really kind of heartened. And I laugh because, you know, it wasn't that Nike was doing that out of the goodness of its corporate heart. They did that as a ploy. I mean, it was all business, all marketing. But, you know, I guess like I was feeling good about it. There was a whole side of the country that was burning their shoes over this this use of Colin Kaepernick in this way. And it, you know, it speaks to the culture wars, I think, that we're very much so in the midst of, you know, but also the fact that corporations, I mean, I read something recently that, you know, in the midst of hiring Colin Kaepernick for this campaign, Nike has just given millions to the Republican Party.
Well, they looked at the giving patterns of its executives and its employees and the corporation, and yes, far more goes to the Republican Party than
Okay,
yeah.
So that kind of makes more sense to me than what I was initially thinking, but it's still, you know, it's still very interesting, you know, the contrast between Colin Kaepernick, what he sort of rose to fame for, and the president that, you know, just really latched onto that as a political issue, right? And then what Nike is doing, at least through its employees and so forth, in terms of the money that's going to the Republican Party, is just very interesting.
It's a business decision. It's a branding decision, but one that everybody has to take seriously, including actresses like Jennifer Lewis, Black-ish star Jennifer Lewis, who was wearing a full Nike outfit at the Emmy Awards and talked about it.
I am wearing Nike in support of Colin Kaepernick's protest against police brutality and racial injustice. I want to speak to the millennials today to tell them they are not alone when they stand up and speak out. I want to talk about corporate America and following through like Nike, and tell them that we're watching and tell them that we care. We are not living in dark times. We are living in awakening times. And I am proud to be one of the leaders in the movement.
Black-ish actress Jennifer Lewis talking on the Emmy red carpet to People TV. So, I mean, well, let's talk about this. It's complicated. I mean, that was a speech, and that was designed to meet an audience, and I suspect, you know, reinforce a brand of her own, if I may. Mm-hmm. That's what I heard. But is that so wrong? We can take that cynically. But look, we really only get to express ourselves fully in the marketplace, in the commercial marketplace. Yeah. So maybe this is precisely where this debate should be taking
place. And I think there's no question that Jennifer Lewis is someone who rides and dies with Colin Kaepernick, right, and feels very much convicted about the kind of critiques that she's making about the NFL. And what she's encouraging Nike to do. But as she talks about these corporate structures, this is also the Jennifer Lewis who can't speak back to ABC and Disney about the fact that the founder of the show, Kenya Barris, is no longer the showrunner, having ending that relationship because of their unwillingness to air an episode in which Dre has this conversation with his newborn baby son about the reality of the world, and ABC felt as though it had and Disney felt that it had crossed the line. She can't speak to that publicly, right? But she can acknowledge it in other ways, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same Jennifer Lewis who also understands Disney's role and someone like Jemele Hill being removed from, you know, Sports Center and things like that, right? So she's much mm-hmm. well given as a veteran in the industry, but she understands these corporate structures. So she can push back on the NFL and Nike in ways that she can't her employers, right? But people who understand what's going on in that context.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about the commercial value of iconic moments and whether or not how sincere they were and what effect they had. When we come back, let's talk about the 50th anniversary of Say It Loud. 50 years since that song hit the marketplace. And we'll talk more about that and much, much more on Back Channel on the State of Things when we continue. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal are with me today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context. And before the break, we heard some of James Brown's 1968 hit, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. It celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Mark, you're going to be involved with a special event at the Apollo later this month to celebrate this anniversary. What are your reflections looking back on the legacy of that song?
You know, it's a song that resonated for many folks. In some ways, released in 1968, it becomes kind of an anthem for the Black Power movement. Mm-hmm. But, you know, James Brown was hesitant around those politics. He really had not written anything that was explicitly political before then. He was not ready to record anything that was explicitly political. And there was a lot of pressure exerted on James Brown. Largely from the Black Panther Party. He met privately with the Black Panther Party all throughout 1968, who felt as though, as an artist that was being supported by the Black community, that was highly visible, that he had a responsibility. I think it's not surprising that when he goes into the studio to record the song, August of 1968, it's after the shootings of Black Panther Party members in California. He, in fact, is in California when he records the song. And it was like it was a breaking moment for him, right, that he had to find some way to give voice to the movement. And that's what it was. Not lost on this is that, you know, this would be James Brown's last top 10 pop hit until Living in America comes out on the Rocky soundtrack almost 20 years later. Right. So as a commercial artist, right, he actually gave up something, you know, for making this political stance. Same thing occurred with Curtis Mayfield earlier that year. When he does a song like We're a Winner, and both Black and white radio stations refused to play the song because they thought it was too militant. And he was at a point in his career where he could withstand that, right? He had built big enough of a brand that he could finally step out and make a political statement.
Natalie?
Well, I was just going to say that it's really interesting to me that James Brown lost something, as Mark said, you know, through the writing and release of Say It Loud, the militancy, I guess, that was perceived about it. Because one of the things that I looked at recently that I just think is really funny is this 1969 Playboy After Dark performance by James Brown of the song, and he is surrounded
by white people.
By white people. And they're just clapping and dancing, and you know, and it's like tone deafness to the hilt. Like they're not making a connection between what he is talking about, you know, which is an affirmation of black beauty, black power. You know, yet in a moment where that was you know, it, well, the Black Panthers were at their height, and there was a real movement for militant change in the Black community, or change, period. So it's just very interesting that, you know, to me that, that James Brown lost something when white people seem to eat up James Brown's music, and this song in particular.
And, you know, R.J. Smith makes this point in his book, The One, his great biography of James Brown, that for many white folks, however they loved his music, he was this kind of wailing, indecipherable sound all the way at the end of the dial, right, where all the black radio stations were. So there's a way in which they didn't even really know James Brown in that way. And, of course, then James Brown is complicated, right? So because a year after this song, he's caping for Richard Nixon, right, under this idea that Richard Nixon's going to create a context for black businesses to flourish in black communities, which really was James Brown's politics.
Well, it was very much, and I wonder, I'm going to play this clip. It was on the Mike Douglas Show, but then they played a clip from a news conference that he had done in Washington, D.C. So this would have been James Brown in 1969 talking about his role in the movement.
You know, in Augusta, Georgia, I used to shine shoes on the steps of a radio station, WRDW. I think we started at 3 cents, and we went to 5 and 6. Never did get to a dime. But today, I own that radio station. You know what that is? That's black power.
That's James Brown playing a clip of him from a news conference. He was on the Mike Douglas Show, 1969. And, of course, we're talking about this in the context of Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, 50 years later. I mean, Mark, this plays right into, right, the trope that the complaint and the critique in white America that there's nothing wrong with our system. Look at James Brown. Why can't you do what James Brown did? I mean, he started out as a shoeshine boy, and now he owns radio stations. Why don't you just go ahead and do the same thing? And he's got to know he's playing into that.
Yeah, I think, but I think that's his politics, right? I think there's a way in which the way that James Brown came up, he saw himself as a kind of a singular figure. While I think he understood the value of the black audience, I think he often had questions about whether or not to think of himself as actually part of a black community as opposed to the black exception. And of course, when you have folks like Richard Nixon and all of these kind of other white gatekeepers reminding him, right, about his bootstrap story and how that had in fact made him much more of an exception. You know, we don't hear a lot of stories about James Brown's role with SCLC. You know, we really just get this particular moment around 1968. And in fact, he becomes most visible to white America when he's called on stage at the Boston Garden, you know, to give a concert that's broadcast on TV to make sure that black kids don't go out in the streets and riot after King's death. For many white Americans, that's the first time, you know, James Brown is a thing.
I just think it's so interesting, the connection between Bill Cosby and James Brown, and the fact that here are two black men, black entertainers, who both had conservative politics. The clip that you played, Bill Cosby basically kind of prescribed to the same type of thought in terms of we need to pull up our pants and do all that. So I'm wondering about, you know, is this a generational thing? But I'm also thinking about, and I'm kind of taking us in a different direction, but I think it's related. This, you know, what do you do with the legacy, the artistic legacy of men who, number one, are really not riding for black people, and then number two, who are accused of, and in Cosby's case, you know, convicted of sexual assault and physical,
In the case of James Brown, actual physical violence against the women in his life.
Well, and that the art is unquestionably, whatever their personal lives, their art is unquestionably first rate. And so that you have to deal with this. This artistic output, this production from these individuals, is unquestionably top notch stuff.
I mean, the important part about the art in the case of James Brown is that that song opens up a new space for black music. So when you hear the music, and when you hear "Stand" a year later, you know, Sly and the Family Stone's album that's so distinctly political, when you start to see the moves that Motown makes, first with the Temptations, but most explicitly with Marvin Gaye, when you see the launch of Philadelphia International Records, and they're very clear that this is music that speaks to a particular political moment, that doesn't occur without James Brown opening up black political music to the commercial sphere and being successful doing it.
Which is to say, we can't actually separate the individual and their personal lives from the impact of their art, and then kind of what we do as consumers with that becomes a matter of conscience. Yeah. I want to turn now to a new six-part docu-series about Trayvon Martin. Executive producer on this is Jay-Z. It's called Rest in Power, and it premiered on the Paramount Network this summer. And I want to start with a clip of Trayvon's father, Tracy Martin, talking about his reaction to his son's death.
A detailed officer pulled up, and an unmarked vehicle. He asked me to sit down. He told me it had been an altercation.
Tracy automatically began saying, "Don't tell me it was my boy. He just repeated it several times. Don't tell me it was my boy."
He slid a crime scene photo to me and asked, "Was that my son?" I can remember going up there in the room. I didn't get a chance to hug him before he died, and so it was just the smell of the fabric softening the clothes that he had. And I can remember getting on my knees, just holding the bag, and you can't really explain the feeling, man, unless you actually been there.
There's a clip of Trayvon Martin's father, Tracy Martin, from the six-part docuseries Rest in Power that aired on both the Paramount Network and BET this summer. And I'm talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Natalie, let me put the first question to you. The first episode paints a very intimate portrait of who Trayvon was and what his death was like for his family. And I wonder what struck you about this series.
I mean, I was pretty much in tears watching at least the first two episodes because the pain of these parents is so palpable in this series. You know, and then I have a son, you know, who is not that far away from Trayvon's age. So the older that he becomes, you know, the more I am forced to think about Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown and all of these young and older black men, or boys and men, Tamir Rice, who have been killed, you know, either by someone hoping to be a policeman or an actual law enforcement officer. The pain and the destruction of black life, black families, you know, it's all tied up in this visceral, very like gut-wrenching feeling that you get from watching and really reliving, you know, what happened to Trayvon.
Mark?
Tears, definitely. And then anger.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
At the criminalizing of Trayvon after his death, the criminalizing of his parents and their parenting skill. You know, you can ask all kinds of questions about why Trayvon Martin is dead. And yeah, we'll put that fully at the feet of white supremacy and anti-black racism. But we also have to put it at the feet of what we could describe as white male entitlement.
Absolutely.
You know, Zimmerman had the inability to stand down. He felt entitled to police that community. He felt entitled to police black male bodies. Even as the police officers are telling him, "We don't need you to do that.
That's right.
Go home." He still felt entitled to do that.
And just to complicate that a little bit, George Zimmerman wasn't even white.
Right.
He was aspirationally.
Right. Right.
This is how you get aspirational
entitlement. Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that's how you assure your membership. But it does talk about a system that then affirmed that entitlement, not only systemically by exonerating Zimmerman, but also ultimately in the way the system played out. And you talked about this, the criminalization of the family. In the series, it takes an in-depth look at the trial and tactics of both sides, and it includes the testimony of Rachel Johntal, who was the last person to speak to Trayvon Martin. And here's a clip about how she was treated during the deposition and court testimony.
Are you able to read that copy well enough that you can tell us if it's, in fact, the same letter?
No.
Are you unable to read that at all?
I don't understand. Curses. I don't read curses.
You can hear laughing in the courtroom, but I didn't find anything funny.
She's sort of seen as this sort of ghetto figure. When she's a girl, she's a kid.
Don't tell me that those jurors weren't thinking this young black girl is different from me, because they were.
She was the most bizarre witness in 20 years I've probably seen on the stand.
I'm sorry, she comes in jeans and a sweater and a little blouse.
You gonna say I'm big, I'm black, she talk ghetto.
We have to excuse her poor manners, her disrespectful language, and cocky ignorance because she's black?
Rachel Juntill was treated like an ignorant, barely literate black girl. She was pilloried and she was clowned.
That's a clip from the 6-part docuseries Rest in Power that tells the story of Trayvon Martin, premiered this summer. And I'm talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal.
Let me tell you what, when the trial actually happened in real time, I remember reacting to Rachel Juntill's testimony with embarrassment and a level of, please pull it together. Come on, please pull it together. Like wanting her to get herself together so that she reps well in front of this, you know, white jury. But when I watched this docuseries, I felt like I was her. I fully related to her and felt like I could be her, because the reality is, as a black girl, and Rachel wasn't even given that ability to be a kid. She was seen as a adult, just as Trayvon was. But she could have spoken the King's English. She could have been on her best P's and Q's. It would not have mattered. And the reality is that her, you know, what she reflects in her testimony, the fact that she can't read cursive, well, that is, my kids are having a hard time with that too. Why? Because it's not taught in the schools.
Right.
So there are all these things that are going on in our educational system, that are going on in our country, you know, racially, that she sort of embodies in this moment. And instead of triggering some sort of recognition of what needs to be addressed, she is pilloried and clowned, right? She is talked to and demeaned in, you know, the most degrading way. So Trayvon Martin's death was really, it absolutely was a wake-up call, and that it took place during the presidency of the first black president, underscored the idea that we are not post-racial. Right. And that there is so much that we still have to deal with when it comes to race and how we use it to interpret guilt and innocence, who's a victim and who's the predator.
And we have to be honest, you know, Natalie, it has enough class that whatever you might have been feeling in that initial moment, it ain't out there on black Twitter. You know, black Twitter was as much involved in the clowning of Rachel over these ideas of black respectability that were very, very troubling, particularly from black men who felt that, you know, in this protection of Trayvon, she needed to bring something else to the table. But she is a girl. I saw her and I saw my then 10-year-old chubby little black girl. Right. She's not chubby anymore. But that's who I saw on, and wondering how she would process being in that kind of moment. And we know this from all the research about black girls and the way they're criminalized in schools. Mm. Whatever they're wearing, right, they're seen as being too much.
Right.
However they're talked, they're seen as being talking back and all. So you're right, Natalie. It doesn't matter what. Right. How she sounded, what she would have wore, she was going to be seen as illegitimate simply in being in a black female body.
Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke, distinguished professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and author and also the host of the webcast Left of Black. Thank you both so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
We'll do it again next month. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.